There are people alive today who remember the tail end of European empires in Africa. The Belgian Congo, for example, still existed until 1960. Younger listeners may hear the name and wonder what that was about. And our guest this hour explains by detailing how the powers of Europe, big countries and small, moved into the Congo River Basin and made Central Africa their own starting around 1880. They often devastated the land and the people. Robert Harms lays this out in the book Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. Robert Harms is a professor of history and African studies at Yale University, the author of several previous books on African history. Those include The Diligent, a study of the slave trade that won several awards. Robert Harms, thank you for joining us.
Very happy to be here.
Not your first examination of Africa, obviously, in book form. What do you want to do differently with this book?
Well, various pieces of this story that I tell have been told before in other books that usually focus just on what became the Belgian Congo and focused on the misdeeds of King Leopold of Belgium. And as a person who had once spent 2 years teaching in a high school in the region of Maniema in the Eastern Congo, and Maniema figures fairly prominently in the book, and then who later did 2.5 years of oral history research along the middle stretches of the Congo River with a dugout canoe and a 6-horsepower motor going up and down the river and collecting oral traditions from the elders in the various villages. And so I wanted to write a story that brought all the different pieces together, and that includes the Arab and Swahili-run ivory trade coming from the East African coast. That also included the French coming in from the Atlantic coast of Africa, and in the middle, in between the two, was then the Congo Free State, as it was called. It wasn't because the people are free, but it was because it did not really belong to any country, even though it was a colonial entity. It belonged personally to King Leopold too, and that's why it was called a Free State, because it was not connected to any nation. And to me, the three stories, the stories of the East African ivory trade in Maniema and the stories of the French in the Atlantic areas of Equatorial Africa and the Congo Free State in the middle were all intertwined, and it was really one large story, and I wanted to tell it that way rather than the way it's always been told in little pieces in other writings.
You do make it easy to understand by that division into thirds of Maniema, the Congo Free State, and the French Congo in the west. But you also explain what it was that really kept Europeans from making huge inroads into the area until about the 1880s. Talk about some of the natural barriers and other factors that kept Europeans mostly out.
Yeah. The Portuguese first arrived at the mouth of the Congo River in 1482. And for 400 years, they operated along the coast, buying slaves that were brought to the coast by African slave caravans, actually. And they never went inland. And so 400 years later, nobody knew what went beyond the rapids. Because if you go up the Congo River, at its mouth, it's 7 miles wide, and then you go up and for 100 miles, and then you hit rapids and a waterfall. And then if you go around that waterfall, you find another waterfall, and you find 200 miles of rapids and waterfalls. And so the Europeans didn't even try very hard to find out what was behind that, because they were trading and making money by sitting on the coast. And so from the west, then, nobody knew what the course of the Congo River was, even though it's one of the largest rivers in the world. And from the east, if you start in the Indian Ocean coast near the equator and start heading west inland toward the heart of Africa, you're in basically savanna, grassland, prairie land with occasional trees for the first 750 miles, and then you hit a series of mountains, and on the other side of those mountains, you hit equatorial rainforest. And it's very hard to travel in the rainforest and so on. So people, the ivory traders and others, didn't really even try to go into the rainforest until around 1870, when the savanna area started to run out of elephants and the ivory trade started to fall off. And then they decided they needed to go into the forest and start finding new sources of ivory.
So and, very, very standard story. We're moving west because we've used up the resources here in the east.
That's it, exactly.
Well, okay, so and, go ahead.
Well, and at the same time then, there was this friend, well, he was an Italian who worked for the French named Brazza, and he started going up the Ogowe River on the Atlantic coast of Africa, and he thought that would take him into the heart of Africa and avoid, you know, the rapids of the Congo River. And so while this Arab and Swahili ivory traders from the East African coast were moving into the eastern part of the rainforest, then he was moving in to the western part of the rainforest. And at first he got within 100 miles of the Congo River, but he knew where he was, but he didn't know where the Congo River was, so he didn't know where he was. And he turned north, and for months he traveled parallel to the river, about 100 miles away, and then he came, he retraced his steps south, and so for many months he was within 100 or 200 miles of the Congo River and didn't know it, and then he went back.
All right, let's pick up the story on the other side of a break. The book is called Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. Historian Robert Harms from Yale is our guest and the author of the book. Back on the Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Robert Harms, a professor of history and African studies at Yale University, is our guest with a well-researched new book called Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. You can join our conversation on the Exchange as we talk about what led to the likes of the Belgian Congo at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So to restate, we're talking about basically three separate regions of Central Africa in the general area of the Congo River, Maniema, the eastern third, the Congo Free State, the middle third, and the French Congo, the western third. You provide names for us to get familiar with these places, people who were instrumental in their development, at least in European terms. You were just talking about Brazza. Pierre Savagnin de Brazza is the Frenchification of his Italian name. For the French Congo, a fellow named Tipu Tip will talk about in a moment for Maniema. But Henry Morton Stanley is a key figure in the Congo Free State. And this is the same Stanley who met Dr. Livingstone?
Yes. Stanley is quite a character. He was born in Wales as with the name John Rowlands, and his mother abandoned him, and his father was unknown, and he was raised in what they called a workhouse, or some people would call a poorhouse. And eventually he catches a cotton ship to New Orleans, and while he's in New Orleans, he learns about this big cotton shipper in New Orleans named Henry Hope Stanley. And so he calls himself Henry Morton Stanley, and he claims that the cotton shipper had adopted him in a private ceremony but never made it official, which wasn't true. But then he fights on both sides of the Civil War because living in New Orleans, he joins the Confederate Army, and then when he gets captured and he's in a prison camp, the Union soldiers say that they'll let him out if he joins the Union side. So he fought on both sides of the Civil War. Then he becomes a journalist who covers the Colorado Gold Rush and some of what they then called the Indian Wars in the Great Plains, and eventually makes his way to New York and becomes an international correspondent for the New York Herald. And one of the things he decides to do is go find the famous explorer David Livingstone, who was off in Africa someplace and nobody had heard from him for over 2 years. And he thought it would make a great story if he could find him. So he did find him, and it turned out that Livingstone was trying to find the source of the Nile River. Well, Stanley went back with his story, and Livingston kept looking for the river, and he died about a year later. And so then once he was dead, Stanley went to his newspaper, the New York Herald, and said, well, if you'll sponsor me, I'll go find the source of the Nile River. So they sponsored him, and so he ends up at a place where Livingston had also been but had sort of got stuck. It's what's now the Upper Congo River, but it flows north, and he thought it would flow into the Nile, and then he would end up, you know, in Cairo. And so he starts following, gets some canoes, steals them basically, but gets some canoes. He's following the river north, and he thinks he's on the Nile, and then it makes a huge U-turn. It moves to the northwest and then the west and then the southwest and then heading south, and then it makes a sharp right turn toward the Atlantic Ocean, and he realizes that he has now traced the course of the Congo River, which no Europeans had a clue as to exactly where the Congo River came from or until the waters reached its mouth. So then Stanley goes back to Europe and tries to sell the Congo as a big business venture, as a place, he says, it's full of resources. And also there are a lot of people there who will trade their resources to buy the products of European manufacturing, mainly cloth that was produced in Manchester, England. And so the British weren't interested. So eventually King Leopold of Belgium is interested. And again, it's not for the Belgian government. It's a personal project. And he hires Stanley to go back to the Congo and build a wagon road around the 200 miles of rapids. And once you're around the rapids, the river is free, and you can, if you put a steamboat on it, it can sail for 1,000 miles before it runs into it, any obstacles. So that was the plan, and Stanley then builds his road, and they start putting steamboats on the Upper Congo River, first of all to collect ivory. Mm-hmm. And what they're collecting is what they called at the time dead ivory, and that means elephants that had been killed years ago, and the meat had been eaten, and nobody knew what to do with the tusks, so they would just keep them around, but they had really no use for them. And so the Europeans could then come in and buy this ivory very cheaply. But once all the dead ivory was bought up from one place, they had to keep moving. And the whole dynamics of the ivory trade, with the Arab and Swahili traders coming in to the forest from the east and the Europeans coming in from the west, is that the ivory frontier is constantly moving. Because you're in the rainforest and you're basically dead ivory. Because there are a lot of elephants in the rainforest, but they're very, very hard to hunt because the forest is so dense you can't see them.
All right. Take a breath here for a moment. I want to remind people we're talking to Robert Harms from Yale University about his book, Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. So they were dealing with basically found on the ground kind of ivory that no elephant had to grudgingly part with, but it turned then into a let's kill the elephants thing.
Yeah, and then you also had a rise in elephant hunting. But they couldn't hunt new elephants fast enough to meet the demand. And the demand was driven in part because pianos in Europe and the United States were becoming very popular. Every middle-class household had to have a piano, and the pianos had to have ivory keys. And places like Ivoryton, Connecticut, which made most of the piano keys for American piano manufacturers, were importing 20 tons of ivory a year to keep up their piano key business. So the increased demand for ivory coming from Europe and the United States drove up the price, and that made the ivory hunters, you know, more eager to get as much ivory as they could, as fast as they could.
Right, there's the incentive. But let's talk about the societies that existed on the ground before the exploitation began. Then, I mean, how well organized or not were the people who lived in the Congo Basin?
Yeah, one of the things throughout the forest, and I'll talk about the forest societies, is you have to then, the forest is so dense, you have to make a clearing. And then you build a little village in the clearing, and that village is pretty isolated from, you know, any other villages. And so each village was more or less independent. And you didn't have the large kingdoms like you had in other parts of Africa, or the powerful chiefdoms or so on. You had a lot of just small-scale organization and independent villages, and that system worked perfectly well. And if two villages, for example, got into a fight with one another and, you know, had a battle, well, it's not that the one village was trying to conquer the other village and expand its territory because it's too hard to control. It's just that you want to solve your problem and, you know, restore peaceful relations that had existed before the quarrel came up. So warfare was a small-scale affair. Politics was a small-scale affair. And so people living there were not really prepared when these outsiders, either from the Swahili coast or from Europe, start coming in with their guns. And Stanley was one of the first to enter Equatorial Africa with a repeating rifle that could shoot 15 bullets. It's one of the innovations that had come out of the American Civil War. Later, Stanley comes back in 1889 in another expedition, and he's got the first true machine gun with him. It's called a Gatling gun. Oh, no, this is called a Maxim gun, which is different from a Gatling gun. So the people had a system that worked fine as long as there were no outsiders with guns running around trying to strip their area of its resources. But once they were confronted with these people, they were really not prepared to defend themselves very well.
No, indeed. Robert Harms is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of history and African studies at Yale University. His book is called Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. You're welcome to join our conversation on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions and comments online at jx@jeffnet.org, by phone 800-838-3760. Now, you describe, Robert, using mostly European sources from the period because that's primarily what's available. How self-aware were any of the people whose works you used of the destruction and dislocation and death they ultimately brought?
Well, I think they were quite aware of it. Some of the people, one interesting person is a character I talk about at one point named, he's an American named Edgar Canisius. And he goes to the Congo and gets a job working for one of the big rubber companies there. And these rubber companies were things that had been given concessions of territory that were often two to three times as large as Belgium itself. And they recruited private armies, and they just went in and forced people to go out into the forest and find the Landolphia vines that contained rubber and tap them and bring in a certain amount of rubber every 2 weeks. And if they tap a certain vine too often, then it dies, and then they have to go farther and, you know, find new vines. And so it became a horror system because people were going farther and farther into the woods as the vines were running out. And then they would run into people from another village coming from the other direction who were going farther and farther into the woods. And and you start getting a crisis where people know they'll be severely punished or killed if they don't bring rubber, and there's no rubber to bring. And Edgar Canisius, the American, was working for one of these rubber companies at the time, and he observed several times where certain areas would just go into full revolt against the rubber company, And then what the rubber company would do is call, by then the Congo Free State had been formed, and they would call the Army of the Congo Free State, which would come up in, you know, in a steamboat, and they would then attack all the people who were in revolt and put down the revolts. And he participated in that for 2 years. But he must have felt guilty, but it didn't stop him from doing what he was doing. And when he left, he was given a commendation for excellent service and a big, you know, $500 bonus and congratulations for being such a wonderful employee in this horrible rubber scandal. But then once he got home, he felt guilty about it, I guess, and he wrote this book, which he criticized and exposed a lot of the horrors of the rubber scandal that he had been involved in. So you have people who are aware of what's going on, but for one reason or another, participate, partly because they're making a lot of money very quickly.
Yeah, well, that always helps get people's attention diverted. Robert Harm's book is called Land of Tears. Let's talk about Tipu Tip, who came in from the east of this with the Arab and Swahili traders. This is a great detail you provide where Henry Morton Stanley struggles with his description of Tip.
Yeah, most history books refer to him as an Arab, and certainly his genealogy comes from a lot of Arab families from Oman, who in the 19th century moved down to Zanzibar in the East African coast, and then started moving to some of the trading centers farther inland. But on his mother's side, he might have had an African mother, or at least an African grandmother, and so he looked more African than Arab, even though he was known as an Arab and dressed like an Arab. But what he could do with that then is that if he was among Arabs, he could be an Arab, and if he was among Africans, he could say he was an African. And that allowed him to travel with his caravans throughout the eastern part of East Africa and Manyema, and make deals with, you know, local African chiefs and so on. And soon he turned what had been just a trading company into an empire and a state that was governed. And people then would be required to bring so much ivory as tribute for each year. And so he started out buying ivory, but soon he was just collecting it as tribute, basically getting it for nothing. And then building up a large empire that ran like 500 miles along the upper Congo River, and then inland on both sides for maybe 100 miles or so. And so he had a fully formed state there that was basically a massive vacuum cleaner for vacuuming up all the ivory that was available.
Now, Tipu Tip was a nickname. His real name was Hamid bin Muhammad.
Hamid bin Muhammad.
Yeah. Why was he called Tipu Tip?
Well, he wrote an autobiography toward the end of his life, and he tells the story that he was in a battle against a certain Luba chief named Samu, and his followers were armed with guns, and they were shooting at Samu's people, and afterwards, people, and he won the battle, of course, and afterwards people said that his guns frightened them, said they'd dealt with guns before, but his went like tip, 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 and so they called him Tip Tip, and then it moved into Tipu Tip, because it's easier to pronounce. But he was very proud of that, and when he wrote his autobiography, he entitled his autobiography The Story of Hamid bin Muhammad El-Murjabi, known as Tipu Tip. So he put it right there in his title, and he was proud, very proud of his nickname.
Robert Harms, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. It is about the fact that European powers moved into Africa pretty much from 1880 until 1900, and that cast a long shadow. There are still vestiges of European imperialism in that part of Central Africa today. We'll return to the conversation. If you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. A reminder, as we head to the break, the Jefferson Exchange will not air in this time slot tomorrow because instead we'll be carrying the House debate on the articles of impeachment. So no morning edition of the Jefferson Exchange on Wednesday and possibly Thursday as well, depending on how long the business of Congress goes on. Back here on the Jefferson Exchange today with Robert Harms, Land of Tears, and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Robert Harms, professor of history and African studies at Yale University. He's written several previous books on Africa. This one gives us a focus on European incursion into Central Africa, generally along the Congo Basin rainforest. The book is called Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. The range of the book is generally from 1880 into the early 20th century. You can join us on the exchange with your questions, comments at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So again, the book really deals with the region in thirds. Manyema, the eastern third of the rainforest, where Tipu Tip is a primary figure. The French Congo, the western third, with Pierre Savarnyan de Brassa, who's an Italian and becomes a French citizen. The most influential figure there. And then the Congo Free State, the middle third, with the influence of Henry Morton Stanley, of Stanley and Livingston fame. What we haven't talked about so far, Robert, though, is what gave Belgium and King Leopold II the idea to get so ambitious and seek land many times the size of Belgium itself in this part of the world?
Well, King Leopold had wanted to make Belgium bigger when he became the king. And he thought of fighting some wars against Holland and Germany and so on and to expand his kingdom, and he decided that he'd probably lose. So he started looking for territory overseas. And so when he heard that Stanley had discovered the course of the Congo River and was coming back to Europe, he was interested. He thought, now maybe in the Congo we can, gain the land that we couldn't gain in Europe. And so that was his original idea. And then he's looking for how do you finance it. And then he wants to control the ivory trade that's getting going. And he ends up actually making a deal with Tipu Tip, and he's starting to buy Tipu Tip's ivory. And so instead of carrying the ivory to Zanzibar on the Indian Ocean coast, he sells his ivory to King Leopold, who takes it down the river in his steamboats. And then when the ivory starts running out, he gets the idea of exploiting the rubber. This is wild rubber. It's in rubber vines in the forest. It's not rubber trees like in a plantation. But it's finding the rubber and exploiting it is such a difficult process. If it was done just as, on a free market trade basis, it would be a money-losing proposition. So this idea was to force people to go out and bring in rubber for nothing, basically, and to force people to go out and strip the forest of its rubber resources that he could then ship to Europe and sell to make money. So he didn't have the resources to do that, but he would then, as I say, find investors who would form companies, and then they would hire employees and soldiers and stuff and move in and basically conquer these areas that were assigned to them, and then force everybody to bring in usually a quota of rubber, like 15 pounds of rubber every other week or something like that. And they just, the whole area then becomes just sort of locked down under the constant exploitation by the rubber companies.
So did DeBraza, Stanley, and Tipu Tip comment upon the encroachment of the Europeans, and were they basically pushed out of the picture, or did they voluntarily just get out of there?
No, there's just, I mean, it's a weird thing in two ways. Tipu Tip eventually ends up being working for King Leopold and being the governor of the Eastern Congo. Now, that's a complicated story, basically, Tipu Tip doesn't want the Europeans to attack him. And King Leopold says, well, if you'll deliver ivory to me, we'll make you the governor of the Eastern Congo, and then we won't attack you because you're part of our gang. And so Tipu Tip agrees. And then that's when he starts selling ivory to the Europeans. Later, for complicated reasons, he has to leave Manyema and go back to Zanzibar. And while he's gone, then Leopold's soldiers, the Europeans, decide they're going to attack the other Arabs that are still there and drive them out, which they do. And then Tipu Tip never comes back to Manyema. He built a great big house in Zanzibar near the king's the Sultan's palace, lived the rest of his life as a gentleman in Zanzibar, writing his memoirs. Now, for Braza, he had this idea of a kind of a peaceful colonialism where he didn't push people to bring in things that would make money. And so, as time, he was made governor of what they call French Equatorial Africa, and the French government in Paris started getting more and more annoyed with him because he wasn't making any money, whereas Leopold's Congo was bringing in huge profits. So eventually Braza gets fired. And within 2 years, they've divided the French Congo up into 30 different concessions, each given to a different company, who go out there to do exactly the same thing in the French Congo that the Belgian companies were doing in the Belgian Congo. In terms of collecting rubber and so on. So by 1902, 1903, there's almost no difference between the Belgian system and the French system.
All right, so they all ended up falling into line with each other. Let's take a call here from Al in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Harms, the author of Land of Tears.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, I'm wondering, a lot of time when you read in the history books, of the colonization of Africa by the Europeans, you speak of what they call the rise of national movements, be it that French moving to Algeria and Tunisia, or the Italian to Libya and Ethiopia, or the Belgium into the Congos. And I'm wondering, like, the cover for that, they needed a cover, so how much religion and how much this nationalist superiority is involved? And similar to that, at the same time, you have the Zionist movement that happened in Europe at the same time. And if you compare that to what's going on to the Palestinian today, I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks for that, Al.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, well, this period after 1880 in the history of Africa is often called the scramble for Africa, because the major powers in Europe, yes, had a lot of nationalism, nationalist feelings and fervor. And so once one group moves in and starts grabbing one piece of Africa, then the others all want to go in and grab what they can. And that's why they call it the scramble. And what happened, and what I cover in my book, is that in 1885, there was fear that the different European powers would, you know, start going to war with one another over who would get what pieces of Equatorial Africa. So they had this big conference in Berlin where they sorted it all out, and then it was, you take this part, and you take this part, and you take this part, so that they could all exploit their part of Africa without, you know, going to war with each other. So, I mean, it's partly nationalism, nationalist. It's also partly just, again, just making money. Why should they make money? You know, why should their country make money? Our country should go make money. And so this kind of rivalry, both nationalistic rivalries and economic rivalries, were what's driving it. I don't know exactly how that relates. I'll pass on the question of how that relates to the Palestinians and Israel, because I think that's not exactly related to this issue of how Central Africa got partitioned among the European.
Okay, different kind of thing you're saying. So ultimately, can you are there reliable numbers or estimates of how many people died as a result of the exploitation of Central Africa?
No. There have been books that have given some numbers, but they're not really based on any solid statistics. But around 1906, 1907, there were two commissions of inquiry that went through. And, you know, and certainly tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands killed. And then deaths from other the causes are harder to count. But what happens is when the rubber companies were going into villages and forcing everybody to go get rubber, at some point when the rubber runs out, people go and they abandon their villages and they live hiding in the forest, and where it's much less healthy because the villages are in clearings where you get sunshine and so on. And if you live deep in the forest, it's all dusty and damp all the time. And a lot of respiratory diseases come up and so on. So the total number of people that died, you know, because of that is probably large, but it's very, very hard to put a number on it because, you know, nobody knew what the population was at the time. And a lot of people, especially who died of diseases, you know, while hiding in the forest, their deaths, you know, were never known or counted. So I'll just say the number of deaths was high. I won't try to put a number on it.
Now, the governments of the exploiting powers did investigate the treatment of the people in Africa at some point anyway. What did they find, and were there any results to the investigations?
Yeah, the British and the other powers that had been at the Berlin Conference eventually forced King Leopold to send a commission to investigate what was going on in the Belgian Congo. And the commission came back and it said that, you know, the reports of atrocities were true, basically. It confirmed them. But it didn't really offer any solutions. It said, oh, people should be allowed to bring in as much rubber as they can find, and, you know, there shouldn't be quotas, and people should be allowed to pay their taxes by bringing in other things. And similarly, the French sent out a commission to do a similar investigation, and they again found all sorts of horrible things going on. And what happened there is the French government buried the report of the commission, and it was never seen for years. So it was never known, and they made a few what they called reforms. But again, it looks like a lot of the horrors of the rubber companies kept going until the 1920s, when by then the world rubber market was based on mostly rubber from the plantations of Brazil and Southeast Asia, and that wild forest rubber wasn't really much in demand. And then finally, the last French rubber companies finished up their charter and went out of business. But so the reports were useful in verifying that what certain missionaries or certain employees of the companies were saying was true. But in terms of of reforms, they didn't amount to much.
We have less than a minute left, Robert. I just want to ask about the development of the countries that were exploited. I mean, they've been they've had trouble since the disruption, haven't they?
Yeah, certainly, especially the former Belgian Congo, which was called Zaire for a while and is now called the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has never fully recovered, I think. And even today now, we know that the Chinese are coming in and trying to sign contracts for control of certain, resources. And now the Russians are coming in. And the Europeans have always been there. And the Americans, so they're doing the same thing in a different way, that instead of looking to control land, they're now looking to control contracts.
Right. So here we go again with some of the same activity that led to the incidents recounted in the book Land of Tears, The Exploration and Exploitation of Equatorial Africa. It's the work of Robert Harms from Yale University. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
All right. Take care. That will do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Exchange. If you're listening in the morning, you'll hear As It Was and then The Takeaway. If you're listening in the evening, As It Was and news from the BBC. The program is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt's at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.